Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, I'm going to talk about the failures of privatization. And again, you know, I've been on the program, about 8 years now, asked almost monthly, someone, show me privatization, where it's worked, where it's benefited you, me, where it's benefited society. Still nobody telling me. We're going to talk about that. Also, President Obama was in Phoenix today, talking about the foreclosures and the housing market. More of the same, I guess, but we'll go through some of that. More on the most recent education scam, and it is Transportation Tuesday. Roads and bridges need work. What? What? Say it isn't so. No, no. Everything's fine. Everything's wonderful. At least if you listen to the Republicans who have been off on vacation, you know, doing whatever. Not so much urgency to pass a transportation bill. Also going to take your calls, questions, comments, emails, whatever's on your mind. You can call us 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, or email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Today, 1965, this day, very day, right here, 1965, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. He said, today is a triumph for freedom, as huge as any victory that has ever been won on any battlefield. And you go back and you think about what a Herculean effort this must have been given that time frame. I cannot fathom that the political machinery of the day, judging from what I see today, could have passed something like the Voting Rights Act. Now, there are some who say it was very weak and but it was a start. We can't even get that. We couldn't even get a health care passed. Come on. We can't get a simple transportation bill passed. Not something that is culture changing, something that is societal changing like this. You know, amazing stuff. And, you know, before the Voting Rights Act, you know, you go back and you say, well, you know, people had the right to vote. Well, no, they didn't. They may have legally had the right to vote, but good luck on that, because there are always borders in the way. There are always boundaries. Like if you came to, like if you're a black person came to vote, oh, it's the wrong day. You must have got it wrong. You're at the wrong polling station. And who would you go to? Down in the South? Nobody. Told that, well, you know, the voting people, they're not here. Come back late. Or that you can't read, so here, take this literacy test. Oh, gee, you can't recite the entire Constitution? Sorry, you can't vote. What? What? You don't know every member of the House of Representatives? Sorry, you can't vote. You can't explain, procedural, stuff at the state house level? Sorry, you can't vote. Sorry. Sorry. I wonder, as I go back and I read some of the history of this, I wonder how many of the white voters could have passed those tests. I think that I know a good number of the members of the House of Representatives. There's no way that I would be able to name all 435 of them. And if you throw in the Senate, there's just no way I could name all 535 of them. But that was the law back then. That's how things were done back then, pre-Voting Rights Act. So think about how historic this is. And, a couple of the things that I came across that I wanted to share that I thought were important show how huge the Voting Rights Act was. In Mississippi, one of the states that had some of the most restrictive laws for African Americans, voting turnout in 1964, before the Voting Rights Act, 6% of blacks turned out to vote. In the election following 1965, when it was put into place, the election of 1969 saw 59%. And you wonder why those Southern Democrats and a number of Republicans fought against it. Didn't want those people voting. No. So to combat that, Nixon in 1970, he said, well, what we need to do, lower that voting age so we get more voters in, more white voters in. I mean, you think, oh, it was a wonderful thing that they did. They lowered the voting age. No, there was a theory behind that. So they lowered it down to 18 as part of the Voting Rights Act, which I'm all in favor of. It was, you know, the reasoning was bad, but I agreed with it. But you look at, you know, the fights that are going on in capitals across the country. And you look at the fight that went into this. And, you know, I think back to the march in Selma across the Selma Bridge where John Lewis, congressman, was nearly killed, bashed over the head by the Alabama State Police. And, you know, you think back and you go, you know, without the Voting Rights Act, you don't have John Lewis as a congressman. You don't have Marco Rubio as a senator, be that good or be that bad. You don't have Obama as president, be that good or be that bad. You don't have the diversity. And this Congress, the 113th Congress, is what they're saying, the most diverse Congress in the history of the United States. They've got 97 elected minorities as elected representatives, 97 of them. In 1965, there were 5 black members of Congress. Today, there are 44. So the right would go, yeah, see, it worked. It tilted the scales. Yeah. Interesting. But some other interesting numbers that came out. 1965, only 31% of eligible black voters were registered. You fast forward that today, 73%. And I keep going, I can't believe it's that low. It should be 100%, but 73%. That's pretty impressive from just, you know, a number of years, 48 years ago, 31%, pretty impressive. And then I was remembering, I had the opportunity to interview a guy named Syed Khan a couple years ago who had written a nice book about organizing. And, he was, you know, down in the South during this period of the civil rights movement. And he was telling stories about, the battles that went on and the racism and all of that stuff. But one story stuck with me. He was down there registering voters right after this was signed. And there was a woman who was a former slave. She was like 102 years old. And she couldn't get out of her rocking chair. And, you know, she said, I'll be happy to go register to vote if you can get me down there. So 4 people picked up her in her rocking chair, put her in the back of a pickup truck, drove her down to register to vote. And he said, you know, you think about that moment. Think about the history that went in. This was someone who was a former slave. This was somebody who, they were born into slavery, didn't, and now they're going to be able to exercise the right to vote as a free citizen. He said it was just in a moment, and at the time, he understood and appreciated the power of this, the history of it. And, you know, I think about that. You know, I don't know that I would have. But you look at this, and what's going on across the country is there's a war. You know, Johnson had the war on poverty, did all of this stuff with the civil rights movement. And what we're seeing before us right now is really a war on Johnson. The current Republican Party has really pushed in every, I'm not just blaming the talking head politicians, because I don't know that most of them are smart enough to do a lot of this stuff. It's the Alex of the world. It's the wealth classes, front groups. It's all of these think tanks. It's all of that infrastructure that was built around the idea that we need to save the free market. And you go back and you read former Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell's How We Save Big Business and his treatise on, you know, on pushing back and saving free enterprise. Just Google the Powell memo. It was written back in 1971. It is an absolute amazing playbook on how we are where we are today. They absolutely did everything that he said that they should do. And that's why they control the message in the media. And that's why we are seeing these assaults on the war on poverty, these assaults on the Voting Rights Act. That's why we're seeing all of this pro-business pushback and blaming people for being poor. And I read an real interesting op-ed written by Cynthia Tucker, somebody I read occasionally, and basically parroting things I've been saying for the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I got some flack for saying, you know, when a baby comes out and picks door number one or door number two, meaning, you know, not number one or number two, obviously, but being able to choose their parents. Well, she wrote a piece today saying, well, kids should have known better. They should have chosen better parents. And she goes through, she goes, you know, when I was being born, you know, a black child, you know, I picked, parents that were married. They didn't do drugs or alcohol. They worked hard. They were thrifty. They didn't get caught up in the latest trends. They were both college educated. They helped with homework. You know, did all my research. And she said, you know, all that research paid off because here I am. I love what I do. I've had a good life, and it's because of them. And, you know, it's kind of tongue in cheek, but as she points out in her piece that, you know, class more than anything right now determines whether a kid is going to do well, has a chance of climbing the economic ladder, has a chance of getting into that middle class. If you have parents who know how to navigate the system, who know how to get you into keep you on the right track and, well, have the means to raise you in solid middle class neighborhoods without all of the ills of poverty, the violence, the drug addiction, the alcohol, all of the stuff that comes with high poverty rates. And as she points out, you know, people who live in poverty, they don't get tutors at school. They don't get tutors to go to get college exam courses. They don't get help, and they don't have money for tuition. Yeah, she goes, you know, we like to think most of us, you know, our successes are our own, but she says, you know, that's not true. Most of us, the vast majority, are because of our parents, how we were reared, the nurturing, the nature, all of that, the grandparents who were there, the whole structure. And at the end of it, she says quite frankly that the United States has the resource to pour money into giving less affluent children a rich educational foundation from early childhood, but we don't. We behave as if those kids should have chosen their parents better. And as I look at all of the right-wing attacks and all of the blame, and like I've been saying about Representative Reed's poverty tour, it's going to devolve into finger-pointing. And you heard him say, well, you know, it could have been just one bad decision. Like I said, door number one or door number two. You chose the wrong parents. And that kind of rhetoric, that's infuriating. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll talk about a little bit of privatization, some interesting news about the wine and spirit shops, which we revealed last night. I'll bring it back up again in the next segment. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republicans who control the U.S. House are trying for the 40th time to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Protect Your Care and Americans United for Change are launching efforts to counteract the GOP attack on health care reform. Americans United for Change's Brad Woodhouse.
Protect Your Care and Americans United for Change are combining forces to manage an aggressive national communications and rapid response hub here in Washington, which will highlight how the law is currently helping Americans, how it will benefit millions more Americans in the future, and how Republicans would undermine the health security of Americans by repealing it.
Woodhouse says if Republicans ever do succeed at repealing the Affordable Care Act, it would let insurance companies return to bad policies that hurt health care consumers.
Insurance industry could again deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, including for pregnancy. It could again discriminate based on gender. Again, insurance companies can impose large premium increases in copays for preventive care. Insurance companies would no longer have to keep young people on the plans of their parents till they turn 26.
Even as progressives rally to defend the Affordable Care Act, labor unions remain very concerned about the impact the law will have on existing health care plans negotiated by unions. Among the concerns is a 40% tax on so-called Cadillac health plans, plans that cost more than $10,200 for individuals or $27,500 for families. Many public employee health plans could be near that threshold when the tax takes effect in 2018. There also will be no subsidies for Taft-Hartley multi-employer health plans jointly administered by unions and employers. Unions are also worried that employers will scale back hours to part-time to avoid providing health benefits under the reform. The unions say these issues can be fixed by the Obama administration as the law is implemented. They are working to persuade the White House to address the problems. The North Carolina NAACP and the Forward Together movement took Moral Mondays to the mountains Monday with a rally in Asheville. North Carolina NAACP President Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II says with the legislature out of session, Moral Mondays in North Carolina's capital have been suspended after drawing 10,000 people last week. More than 800 people have been arrested in civil disobedience actions at Moral Mondays, protesting what the NAACP says are the extremist policies of the GOP-controlled state legislature. Here's Reverend Barber during a speech at an earlier Moral Monday rally.
Somehow, through the storm, we're going to make it. Somehow, through this crazy legislature, we're going to make it. Somehow, through the money, we're going to make it. We're going forward. And there's one thing we're not going to do. We are not going back. We are not.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, the wine and spirits shop still on the chopping block. I just talked to someone recently who told me that, you know, here in the fall, they're, you know, the Corbett people and the Republicans hell-bent. Got to get some kind of a victory, save face somehow. Jobs be damned, tax revenue be damned, profits be damned. And you look at the fact that just out, the numbers, you know, the actual numbers that the wine and spirit shops produced, $2.17 billion in revenue in 2012, 2013. A $93 million increase over the previous year brought in a record $512 million in sales tax, liquor tax, and transfers into the general fund, an increase of $18 million, and we want to give that away. Think about that for a minute, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Senator Jim Furlow to come talk to us. He's the primary sponsor of Senate Bill 800, which would modernize the wine and spirit shops, not hand it off to for-profit interest. Senator Furlow, thanks for taking time for us.
Good evening, Rick. Once again, you nailed it directly.
So I look at this, $2.17 billion in revenue. I look at the $512 million in taxes that I don't now have to pay and go, why are we still talking about privatizing this?
Oh, absolutely. When you really think about it, in fact, you know, the general public, once they understand more and more about the so-called privatization debate or debacle, they're becoming less sympathetic in terms of actual polling of the voters. And, you know, in the last 5 years alone, the state store system has provided over $2.5 billion to the Pennsylvania State Treasury. $106 million went to Pennsylvania State Police. Over $8 million went to specific drug and alcohol treatment programs. $22 million was returned to local communities and municipalities. So when you look at it comprehensively in terms of all the benefits, not to mention specifically the availability and the control and the reasonableness of how they sell the system and the liquor each and every day, including to the taverns and the restaurants with the oversight. I mean, we have a great system that represents the common good for the commonwealth. And it's all about ideology with this Corbett administration. He's not focusing in on jobs. He's completely been denied a victory relative to the transportation campaign. And that is the vital issue that this administration should be focusing in on this fall. We need a transportation bill. We did a strong bipartisan measure in the House and the Senate, and we called for a comprehensive approach to raising enough capital dollars to do bridges and roads, and it's a comprehensive program that's intermodal and deals with mass transit, not only in the big urban areas of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, but the smaller paratransits and you know, public transit throughout the Commonwealth. But instead of doing that, they're hell-bent on ideology. Anything that's a revenue center or some way that government does good, they denounce it, not only with the state store system, but they have their sights on privatization of the Pennsylvania Lottery, an extremely profitable and successful system that really works well with not very many employees. And I think they have their sights on FIA. You know, a lot of money changes hands because of the bonding and the provision of FIA grants to students across the Commonwealth. So wherever there's some ability to privatize, they have their sights on that, and that's going to be contrary to the best interests of working people in this state.
I'm absolutely with you. I just look at the profit numbers. I look at what was paid in sales tax. I look at the money that comes into to our coffers that I don't have to make up. And if you look at the $512 million, and walk back with me to the beginning of this, because at the beginning, Representative Terzai and the Republicans said, well, we're going to get $2 billion.
Yeah.
And, you know, quickly that changed down to 1.7, 1.5, 1.
Well, not only that, for Republicans that keep touting that they want to support small businesses, our modernization bill enhances the profitability of taverns and restaurants, which I believe very strongly. I'm board treasurer of the Urban Redevelopment Authority of the City of Pittsburgh. Restaurants and taverns of high quality have been a mainstay at redeveloping our neighborhood business districts. We're in partners, basically, with these restaurants and taverns, and my bill would actually increase the discount allocation for those taverns, which would actually improve their bottom line. And beer distributors, these are decades-owned, multi-generational small businesses. They will be wiped out on the Terzai Corbett McElhaney plan, and there's no reason to do that. We can liberalize the ability of both the beer distributors as well as the taverns and restaurants with beer package reform, which is part of my modernization bill. Again, we should go forward and not continue this demonizing of anything good that government has been doing successfully. They don't seem to want to pick anymore. Under the Reagan years, you remember, they consciously focused in on attacking Social Security, wanting to privatize it. Rick Santorum was a big advocate of that. They want to bankrupt and deny people the right to federal Medicare. We keep hearing about cutbacks and elimination of services under that program. Again, you know, they want to cast this picture that government can do no good, and that's just not the reality that we face and live with each and every day.
Now, you know, I often wonder about why people would vote for someone who tells you, I'm taking a job that I don't believe in. I want a job, and I'm asking for your vote to vote for me so I can go and make sure that government doesn't work.
Well, I think across the board, the Corbett report card is a complete failure, especially in terms of job creation, job retention. We've not seen any progress that other states have made as we move towards more consistent economic recovery.
But he's the more jobs governor.
What's that?
He's the more jobs governor. I mean,
yeah.
Didn't you see? He's created more jobs
well,
in Wyoming, but
well,
that's not a start.
18,000 teachers that would tend to disagree with the good governor, to be honest with you.
You know, he was on Fox Business the other day when they opened up the Dow Chemical facility there in Collegeville, PA, and one of the graphics they had is that Pennsylvania created 100,000 jobs since January of 2009, and I wanted to say, hey, Fox, he wasn't governor for two of those years.
Yeah.
So the good portion of those 100,000 came
before he came into office. Under Rendell administration,
there
was much more of a conscious effort to work and create with business opportunities, entrepreneurism, capital infrastructure projects. I mean, if we could get a transportation bill approved, something akin to what we did in the state Senate, $2.5 billion, we can jumpstart the Pennsylvania economy and not only meet, you know, critical transportation and capital needs, but instantly fuel engineering firms, fuel consultants, environmental impact groups, the trades union organizations, and others who do the hard work of rebuilding our infrastructure. So if we want to jumpstart the Pennsylvania economy, you should focus in this fall on transportation and give up with this ideological hell-bent attack on privatizing the state store system.
I'm with you. But, you know, is it too late? I mean, you come back in the fall, is it too late to get a transportation funding into the system and get people back to work before winter?
Well, he's created the problem himself because, you know, he and Terzai and, you know, all the crazy Metcalf guy from Butler County who considers public transit welfare on wheels.
Old
I mean, what
town.
An outrageous statement for a state representative to make from Butler County when so many Butler County residents rely heavily on public transit to get the jobs, not only in Butler County, but certainly in Allegheny County and the hub of downtown Pittsburgh and Oakland. But, you know, I don't know if it's too late, but if you could singularly focus in on the politics of getting a transportation bill and dispense with this nonsensical, continual ideological attack on state stores and lottery, you know, privatizing the lottery, because he's going to be going into the next election with nothing to show for the 4 years other than having been obstinate and basically violative of people's rights and worker loss of income and jobs.
Well, I mean, he's done an awful lot to destroy public education. That will be his legacy, and I'm sure the wealth class will reward him well for all of the handing off of our public education for the profit interests.
Well, I think, you know, he has some good sectors. I do admit that. Secretary of Transportation Shook has been consistent and comprehensive in his message all across the 67 counties. And I'm worried that we'll see the secretary leave the Department of Transportation because he made it clear, at least when I interviewed him in his initial appointment, that he's here from the private sector. He's willing to hit the ground running, but he needs a capital program to rebuild our critical bridges and roads. And he's, to his credit, he's going to start posting certain bridges as not being safe anymore.
As he should.
And I believe he should do that. There's an opportune time. The governor's got to understand the politics of working with the House Democrats, which they will be willing to work with him. But it can't be his way or the highway. He's got to come to the political realization that, that he has enough fights with his own Republican leadership, House and Senate. He's got to extend a hand of cooperation with the House Democrats. We've already been clear in the Senate on a bipartisan fashion, 45-5. We approved a $2.5 billion transportation bill. Is he capable of doing it? I don't know yet. The jury's still out on that. If he continues with this kind of level of arrogance, this kind of prosecutorial misconduct, although he's the executive of the state, he's not going to make much progress in the fall.
You said a second ago the politics of getting a transportation bill pushed through, and I got to be honest, it's one of those things in my years growing up, transportation was one of those things that you didn't have politics with. Everybody understood you need roads, you need bridges, you need to make sure that people can get to work, public transportation, public roads, whichever, but it was something that, you know, was kind of a given, I think. When did that all, in your years, when did this change?
I think just this continual onslaught of this kind of Tea Party mentality that, you know, all taxes are bad, government can do no good, we pay too much. I think people value government programs and government services when they see and appreciate the value that they're getting for their dollar. That's true for municipal services, police and fire. It's true for garbage pickup and refuse collection. It's true for any number of things, and I don't think anybody would suggest today, especially in Pennsylvania with an older population, that we should rid ourselves of the value and the significance of federal Medicare or the Social Security system. And I think that extends to other value programs. You know, people make a big deal about the state stores. You know, over 40% of the Pennsylvanians don't ever visit a state store. They don't actually buy liquor. And a lot of people, like myself included, may go to a state store 4 or 5 times a year, usually around the holidays or for special events.
Right.
The fact of the matter is, you know, people do value the government services that we get. And I think when people understand the subsidy that's needed to have a transportation system, especially public transit in urban areas, they're willing to pay. I think most Allegheny County residents where I live in Pittsburgh value the community college system. You know, people don't want to see waste. People don't want to see abuse in government in any manner. But the fact of the matter is that if people appreciate and value services, I think they're willing. We see that all the time with tax votes on libraries. We had a recent vote just for a minor increase in Pittsburgh to support our Carnegie Library system. It was approved by 74% of the voters. So, again, I think when there's leadership, when there's light that shines from knowledge and from the humanity of our society, I think people lead and people follow and people are appreciative. When there's these conservatives who continually engage in an ideological harangue around all things government and all profit centers or revenue centers must be privatized because somehow, I mean, just the thought that we're going to get rid of the lottery system and give it to a corporation from Great Britain that is all but bankrupt. I mean, they've laid off staff. They've cheated on their lottery returns. It's just outrageous, and I think people will see that come next spring election with the Corbett situation.
And the interesting thing about that, I sat in on the hearings, and I had to chuckle at the woman who was the CEO of the company admitting that their costs be double the operating cost of what it is for the employees of the Commonwealth to do the same job.
Oh, absolutely. And again, you know, when do we lose sight of the middle class? You know, our country's going to hell in a handbasket. You know, we should be supporting, building not only job retention, but job creation to restore middle class. I mean, the old saying, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. How could that be any more glaring than the U.S. today, especially here in our own Commonwealth? You know, we have to restore quality jobs. I sit on the Port of Pittsburgh Commission in Pittsburgh as well. And part of the transportation bill would fuel the development that we here in Pittsburgh, the Erie port, as well as the Philadelphia port, which is a really large port. But, you know, we have Three Rivers here in Pittsburgh. People would be amazed at how much a barge and other, you know, traffic travails the Three Rivers that are directly tied to companies throughout a 12-county southwestern region here that heavily rely on our port system. So, again, you know, we have to fuel and create the environment in which the private sector can create profit. That's fine. You know, we live in a capitalist system. But the fact of the matter is there's an appropriate role for government to play in delivery of services and making the environment such that jobs can be retained or created.
Last line of question I've got for you, Senator Furlow, and it's going back to the wine and spirit shops. You know, as the primary sponsor of Senate Bill 800,
right,
this modernization, to me, this seems like a rational, reasonable first step. Look, if you want to expand the number of stores that are out there, you want to expand access to it, I get that. I don't know that I definitely don't like the idea of we're just going to fling the doors open and wherever things fly, that's where they fly, which seems to be what I'm being told is what the Terzai plan almost looks like.
Even the McConaughey plan and the governor's plan. I mean, look, I represent a three-county area, the urban core of the city of Pittsburgh, the heart of the African-American community, low-income communities. I have wealthy communities like Fox Chapel. We have probably the biggest and best liquor store. The wine selection is unbelievable. I have small towns up and down the Allegheny and Kiskey Rivers. I do not want to see a proliferation of mom-and-pop liquor stores. There's not going to be the so-called convenience and the selection. You know, the Terzais of the world have tried to propagate this notion that somehow prices are going to be better in privately run stores. I mean, you may get some lost leaders at a Walmart or at a Costco, but the fact of the matter is, no, you know, we're the largest single purchaser of alcohol in the world. Nobody can compete with our prices, and if we free the hands of the LCB to run like the business it really is, they can actually sell outside of the system to other states at a great increased revenue to our own Commonwealth. So, you know, this rhetoric from the right and from the Terzais and Corbetts of the world, it's just nonsensical, and it doesn't sustain the facts when you actually review the situation.
So in the fall, when everyone comes back, this is going to be an issue because I think, and I'm sure you know it's going to be an issue because I think at some point Corbett and Terzai and the rest of them have to be able to claim some victory,
right,
even if it means we, the taxpayers, get screwed over it.
But again, you know, and people don't think about this, but let's just take the growing small companies that we have throughout the state here in Pittsburgh as well, the microbreweries. Under our plan, these smaller businesses would have greater opportunity to be able to sell their wares. You know, we want to be able to have a distributor or the tavern break up a case or break up the six packs so they can push the microbrews or the craft brews as well. You take a company like Joaquin's out in towards the Philadelphia area. They have a significant employment base. They produce 20, 30, 40 liqueurs. They get prime status on shelf space in the liquor store system. That's going to be gone under a private system. The private systems under these other bills, these privatization bills, are going to cater to one large single wholesaler or distributor, and that's going to be lost. And even the new industry of Pennsylvania wineries that are emerging around the state, you know, we give them, the state store system gives them preferential shelf space visibly so that their product can be pushed within the state store system. That's not going to happen under privatization. They're not going to push Pennsylvania wineries. So there are a lot of ancillary issues that I don't think once people understand, you know, I think they have a better appreciation for why we need to modernize and just get rid of this notion, put it into the dustbin of history, this notion of privatization.
And that's why we asked you to come on and give us your thoughts and tell us where we're going with this. Senator Furlow, it's always great talking with you. We appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick, very, very much.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. More working people on the talk.
Hard times are going around, bringing hard luck on New York time. But I'm banking on the 18. Banking on the 18. I'm banking on the 18.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefits Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Tired of hearing nothing but the corporate news and views on commercial mass market radio? Then get your own station. That's not as preposterous as it might sound. Thanks to a freelance, free-range, free-form collective of mostly young activists banded together as the Prometheus Radio Project. This nonprofit group arose in the past decade from the low-power FM pirate radio insurrection, consisting of local progressives who set up unlicensed stations that operate on only about 100 watts of power. Yes, a light bulb's worth. The signals of these renegade broadcasters have a range of up to 10 miles in diameter, enough to cover a town or urban neighborhood. They can create a very localized, democratic, and inexpensive micromedia, providing a way for communities to put their own voices, issues, music, and stories on the dial. But there was that outlaw factor, which allowed powerhouse corporate chains to dispatch the authorities to shut down the tiny units. Prometheus, however, battled the giants with a grassroots campaign to legalize and license low-power nonprofit stations. It took 10 years of uphill slogging, but their tenacious grassroots organizing paid off in 2011 when President Obama signed the Local Community Radio Act. With rules and staff now in place, thousands of low-power licenses will be put up for grabs by nonprofit community groups this October. But you must act quickly if your group wants one, for the window will only be open for 2 weeks in a sort of Oklahoma land rush of the air. Prometheus is now offering assistance to people interested in democratizing the dial and strengthening their communities with these low-watt, high-impact radio signals. This is Jim Hightower saying, so get radioactive. Go to Prometheus Radio Project pronto. That's PrometheusRadio.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Claustrophobia, hypochondria, xenophobia, rolled up into one. Just saying your car, stay in mind, and we won't bother anyone. Cause I'm afraid about the test, but hey, it's done. Please don't get too close to me. Please don't get too close to me.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So you look at this, and you know, the point I was trying to make with Senator Furlow a minute ago is, you know, you're looking at a record sales tax coming in, $512 million. And even if you bought the original privatizing of the wine and spirits shop, even if you bought that they potentially, possibly could get somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion, just real simple, you know, third grade math, that's only 4 years. What happens in year five? Something that they never really laid out. Okay, so we're going to give away all this profit. We're going to give away all this sales tax, all of this revenue, all of this stuff coming in. It's all gone. So, you know, millions of dollars coming in. After a couple of years, you no longer have it. I mean, to me, that's number one. It's the financial part of it. The part that this is an asset that we as citizens of this Commonwealth, we control. It is here for our benefit. Now, as a shareholder of this publicly held entity, I believe that you should, if we decide we want to expand it and we want to make it more accessible, we can do that. But saying we need to chuck the whole system and, you know, the Wild West of liquor, I'm not so thrilled. Because then that gets into a lot of the social ills that who's going to pay for? Who's going to pay for the alcoholism? Who's going to pay for all of the driving related accidents and death and property destruction? Who's going to pay for the enforcement of those entities? Because right now, I've got to be honest with you, you know, when I was a kid, 15 years old, 14, I used to walk into Assad's on the corner, buy my 30-pack of Jobel, the crowd pleaser, at a very young age. Because if he didn't sell it to me, the guy across the street would. And if they both didn't, the guy down the road would. Because it was everywhere. And they're in the business of pushing product. We got to get stuff out the door so we can get more of it. And the more we sell, the more incentive there is from the distributor. Because, hey, we're pushing their product too. Because it's all this downward pressure to get it out. Sorry, you know, as a parent. And, you know, I've said this before, you know, this hypocritical animal called a parent. You know, all the things that I did as a younger man don't necessarily want my kids doing. I think that's all parents. I think we all feel that way. But I don't want liquor on every corner. I don't want booze on every corner. And what's interesting to me with this whole scheme that the Republicans have dreamt up, it looks like, you know, from the way I've been reading it and the people we've been talking to, it looks like the beer distributors would be the ones getting really killed in all of this. Because oddly enough, what people actually want is not more access to liquor. I think most people think like I do. When I want a bottle of, you know, this whiskey or that gin or that vodka, I know where to go to get it. And I'm mature enough and forward thinking enough to know, hey, you know, the party's coming up, I probably should pick up a bottle of this. The interesting part of all this is what people actually wanted was more access to beer. They wanted to go to the supermarket and go, oh, a six pack, put it in, yeah, you know, what the heck, the game's coming up Sunday, a six pack of beer. Go to the gas station or the convenience store or whatever and pick up beer instead of having to buy a whole case. Because I got to be honest with you, right? I've still got the same case I bought 8 years ago when we moved into our house. I wanted to get a six-pack. We were having a couple people over, kind of like a housewarming thing, a little party going on. And I wanted to buy a six-pack. I ended up buying a case. We drank six of them. The other three six-packs sat in the basement. I forgot about them. And, you know, there they are to this day. Probably half of them. I think I've pulled some of them out for other things. But, you know, here we are, you know. I think what it's come down to is most people, that's what they want. But what's interesting, and I just read this new piece over at The Atlantic that is saying that, well, you know, actually beer consumption is going down. Because people have figured out that they like wine. Actually, liquor is going down as well because people figure out, oh, you know, they like wine. In the last 20 years, beer consumption has gone down 20%. Despite the fact that we've had a population growth, domestic production has also fallen, even with the population growth, because it's down. And, you know, even with soda, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. What they're saying is, what they're thinking is, you know, the lower class white guys, you know, the working class, the working poor white guy who's, you know, doesn't have the disposable income to pick up the six pack, he's actually taking the hit. And that's part of the equation. But a bigger part of it is, look, it's the wine, man. And what I find interesting in this is, what people really want is the access to the beer and the wine, not so much the liquor. So I as I'm looking at this, the modernization part of it seems rational. And we should have the conversation about, you know, well, where do we get this stuff? Do we want impulse buying? And for me, the answer is pretty simple. The answer is no. Bottom line on this, what the Republicans have brought us, 2 years of distraction, 2 years of wasted time, wasted energy, wasted hearings, wasted votes, you name it, wasted, wasted, wasted. And no transportation, no jobs plan. But they're going on a poverty listening tour. I guess it's to see that their policies are working. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the privatization because, you know, what we've seen the last 30 years at least, this whole, you know, if we privatize, because this was part of it, if we privatize, you'll have lower prices and there'll be more competition and more competition generates lower prices and it'll be good for consumers. I put out the call one more time. Anybody who can show me where we've privatized something and it's benefited we, the consumers, and it's lowered prices and made things better service-wise and customer service-wise and all of that, I'd love to hear it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws and limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. After President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13, did the court do an about-face with the liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save nine, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickschmithshow.com.
But there are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people. But we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me, because we're having a serious problem with that.
Go. I messed up my entire life because I got high. I lost my kids and wife.
because I got high.
Say what, say what, say what, say what.
Now I'm sleeping on the sidewalk, and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, hey, because I got high. Because I got high. Because I got high.
Oh, yes, the lazy and the drug addict thing. Oh, those people who don't want to work, they just want to get high all the time. Can't pass a drug test. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You gotta love that. It's amazing to me that I actually know a couple of unemployed Republican voters who, you know, I ask, "Can you pass a drug test?" Oh, that, he's not talking about me. He's not talking about. Yes, he is. He absolutely is. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? You can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Call 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Ted Koppel was interviewed on NPR. Had an interesting statement on privatization. He says, "We are privatizing ourselves into one disaster after another. We've privatized a lot of what our military is doing. We've privatized a lot of what our intelligence agencies are doing. We've privatized our very prison system in many parts of the country. We're privatizing the health system within those prisons, and it's not working well." And, well, gee, Ted, thanks for that. It's only about 30 years too late. And you go down the list, and you go, well, you know, what have we privatized that is working well? And for me, healthcare, one of the big ones, it used to be not-for-profit. We used to have community hospitals. How many people remember such and such a community hospital? It was owned and run by the community. Tax dollars. Then during the Reagan years, we got this brilliant idea that, hey, here's an idea. Let's turn that into a business since we're not manufacturing anything anymore. Since we're pushing out all of these manufacturing facilities and all of these jobs overseas, we need to make profit somewhere here, so let's privatize what we have so we can turn a profit. You know, because people are going to need health care, right? You know, you're lying on the ground with a heart attack. You'll pay just about anything to get well, right? Won't you? I mean, you know, just over a year ago, I was writhing in pain, rolling around in our old studio. Had no idea why my chest was just throbbing and I was hunched over in agony. But I wanted it to stop. And at that moment, you could have probably gotten anything out of it. And the healthcare industry knows this, which is why, you know, a gallbladder surgery like I had, they say they've found, you know, $60,000 gallbladder surgery covered by private policies to be about $2,000. And I think back, I was remembering as I was thinking of this, when my daughter fell and broke her arm, and we started getting the bills. And the bills total up to like, you know, like $15,000, $12,000, $15,000 by the time it was all said and done. The insurance company paid like $1,800. That is completely different than when I was younger when, you know, the doctor on the wall had a, you know, okay, if you've got insurance, this is what we'll charge you. If you're paying cash, we'll charge you less. Now it's completely the opposite. You got insurance, they've negotiated for the lowest possible price. We're going to stick it to those cash people because they don't have the insurance. They don't have the people negotiating for them. It's brilliant. And I look at Medicare. Medicare's cost effective. To me, we should be pushing Medicare for all, not these private plans. Because, oh, but Rick, we believe in the private market. Healthcare has been privatized. Private's good. Competition lowers prices. Oh, yeah, where? Or did I miss that? Maybe I missed it. Maybe I completely missed it. I know where private healthcare has been good for the people sitting in the CEO suites. Yeah, you think of the guy from United Health Group. The two CEOs that they've had, the one guy, what did he make, about $1.5 billion over a couple of years? And you go, was that good for us? I mean, the one thing I give Obamacare credit for is it puts a cap on how much the thieves can take. Every dollar of premiums that we pay, we're at least going to get 80 cents of health care out of it. Okay, that's a start. That still means 20 cents out of every dollar going into administrative costs or into profit, which means, oh, yeah, my misery as someone's retired. Hey, yeah, Mitch gambled and I won. But really, can you look at the healthcare industry and go, oh, that was a good, we privatized that, was a good thing to do. Because I can't. Especially when you look around the world and you go, well, you know, in places like Great Britain and places like Canada and France and Germany, where common surgeries are as much as 10 times lower than they are here, you go, is it really, oh, but Rick, we've got the best, because we keep telling ourselves we've got the best. And depending on where you are, you're right. If we've got, you've got the resource, we've got some of the best health care you can get, if you can afford it. If you've got the health care, if you've got the access. And to me, you know, you go down to all of this privatization. Water, for instance, we're privatizing water in this country. I read this report by the people over at Food and Water Watch. What they came up with is that the private companies who we've privatized our water to, they charge up to 80% more for water and as much as 100% more for sewer than we used to charge ourselves. Oh, but, you know, they're reinvesting, right? Yeah, you buy that. Look at the sinkholes sinking below the around the city. Look at all around the country where we've got sinkholes every day because the infrastructure is crumbling beneath our feet. Yeah. You know who water privatization has done well for? Nestle. They buy water for about a hundredth of a penny per gallon. And then they sell it back for like $10. Isn't that great? Because, you know, it's bottled water, Rick, which isn't much different than tap water. They just filter it, run it through a charcoal filter. Ah, it's much better. It only has a little fecal matter in it. Don't worry. And you got companies like Dow who dump dioxin into the water, and then they invest in water for purification systems to get it out. What a win-win. Create a disaster, figure out how to fix it. This way you can profit from it. I mean, it's brilliant. And look, these capitalists, they know the game, man. They absolutely know how to get your buck. And education is the next front. Education is what healthcare was 30 years ago. And in 30 years from now, when they've completely privatized education and a good majority of the kids are getting basically nothing, will we look back and go, oh, it was a good idea? I don't think so. We've got to push back against this privatization is good nonsense, because it's not. And I've yet to find a case where it is. Let's take a quick break. Right back with the second hour. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. You can also email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Don't forget Stitcher. Smartphone, take the program on the go. Quick break, right back with hour two.
Working class majority. Rick Smith.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republicans who control the U.S. House are trying for the 40th time to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Protect Your Care and Americans United for Change are launching efforts to counteract the GOP attack on health care reform. Americans United for Change's Brad Woodhouse.
Protect Your Care and Americans United for Change are combining forces to manage an aggressive national communications and rapid response hub here in Washington, which will highlight how the law is currently helping Americans, how it will benefit millions. millions more Americans in the future, and how Republicans would undermine the health security of Americans by repealing it.
Woodhouse says if Republicans ever do succeed at repealing the Affordable Care Act, it would let insurance companies return to bad policies that hurt health care consumers.
Insurance industry could again deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, including for pregnancy. It could again discriminate based on gender. Again, insurance companies can impose large premium increases in co-pays for preventive care. Insurance companies would no longer have to keep young people on the plans of their parents till they turn 26.
Even as progressives rally to defend the Affordable Care Act, labor unions remain very concerned about the impact the law will have on existing health care plans initiated by unions. Among the concerns is a 40% tax on so-called Cadillac health plans, plans that cost more than $10,200 for individuals, $27,500 for families. Many public employee health plans could be near that threshold when the tax takes effect in 2018. There also will be no subsidies for Taft-Hartley multi-employer health plans jointly administered by unions and employers. Unions are also worried that employers will scale back hours to part-time to avoid providing health benefits under the reform. The unions say these issues can be fixed by the Obama administration as the law is implemented. They are working to persuade the White House to address the problems. The North Carolina NAACP Forward Together movement took Moral Mondays to the mountains Monday with a rally in Asheville. North Carolina NAACP President Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II says with the legislature out of session, Moral Mondays in North Carolina's capital have been suspended after drawing 10,000 people last week. More than 800 people have been arrested in civil disobedience actions at Moral Mondays, protesting what the NAACP says are the extremist policies of the GOP-controlled state legislature. Here's Reverend Barber during a speech at an earlier Moral Monday rally.
Through the storm, we're gonna make it. Somehow, through this crazy legislature, we're gonna make it. Somehow, through the money, we're gonna make it. We're going forward. And there's one thing we're not gonna do. We are not going back. We are not.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Oh, one lie leads to another, two lies covers the other three lies. Now you're in an awful fix. Four lies, you're getting in deeper. Five lies, piling up steeper. Get wise, or you're going to be telling six. You better listen and take care. Don't you tell seven, beware. You won't go
there. Oh, yes, Tony Bennett, the real Tony Bennett, not the one that's in a whole heap of trouble down in Florida for his recent scandal, but the real Tony Bennett just celebrated his 87th birthday, the one you heard there saying, you know, talking about the lies. And our quote of the day, and which I think this is the quote of the century by the Tony Bennett who, well, the focus of Bennettgate, if you will. He wrote in an email, I hope we come to the meeting today with solutions and not excuses and or explanations for me to wiggle myself out of the repeated lies I have told over the past 6 months. Now, in response to that, obviously, he says, you know, all this stuff, all the allegations against him, were all these emails were all taken out of context. I would love to hear how help me wiggle out of the repeated lies I've been telling for 6 months was taken out of context. Anyway, here to help us work through this, this Bennettgate and really the attack on public education is Jeff Bryant. He is the director of the Education Opportunity Network, educationopportunitynetwork.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me on tonight.
So I look at this quote of the century, which I just think is amazing that someone would be dumb enough to write this. But from what I've heard, not a very bright guy to begin with, that he needs help to wiggle out of the repeated lies that he told over 6 months. And somehow that's taken out of context.
Yes, we don't know what those repeated lies were. What we do know is that Bennett and his team found a way to game the system so that a favored charter school operation, by the way, which was operated by somebody who had donated significantly to his campaign and to other Republicans in the state of Indiana.
Oh, that's the big surprise.
Yeah, big surprise there. That the system was gamed so that all of a sudden that charter school's grade in the Indiana school grading system went from a C to an A. Now, a real significant thing to note is that the histrionics and backflips that Bennett did to get that charter school changed, get its grade changed from C to an A, were a similar sort of thing that a traditional public school was asking Tony Bennett to do in order to help them out, and Bennett refused to do that. And now those two traditional public schools have been taken over by a charter school operation where, coincidentally, Tony Bennett's wife happens to be employed.
You know, I remember I had a friend who in high school, he had a grade that went from a C to an A, but it was, and he got caught. They called that cheating then.
Yes.
Do we still call that cheating? Because I look at this, and I'm sorry, overnight magically changing the system, rigging the game, whatever you want to call it, C to an A, to me, still cheating.
It's still cheating, but the way this is trying to be expressed in the media is that Tony Bennett is somehow just a person who practiced poor judgment, that he made a mistake, and that this is not such a big deal, that these grading systems have integrity, and that they should continue to proliferate across the country, which they are. And that's an unfortunate conclusion to come to, because actually these grading systems, regardless of whether they are being commanded by a person like Bennett or other people, have huge flaws.
Well, walk me through this, Jeff, because, you know, I got to be honest with you. Most people like me look at this and go, okay, well, when I was a kid, you know, an A was this, a B was that, a C was this. How do you finagle this stuff? How do you have algorithms? I mean, if we're going to have this kind of simplistic system that says, you know, an A is an A and is a B and all this stuff, because that's how we judge accountability, shouldn't there be some common defining what actually an A or a B is? Because I think most of us think like that.
Yeah, we do think like that. And that's what makes school grading systems the perfect political strategy in order to attack public schools. Because we've all come from a background where we experienced this is what school is all about, isn't it? You get an A or a B or a C or you flunk, and therefore you know what's expected, and you can, act accordingly. However, this is not how these grading systems actually work. When they're being applied to schools, there are two different ways to engineer a grading system. And one way to engineer it is to create these so-called proficiency levels. Proficiency levels are basically cut scores on standardized tests. If you get this mark, you get so many students that pass. If you change the proficiency level, all of a sudden, so many students are failed. And your school is a failure. The proficiency levels can change every year, and they do, especially in a place like Florida. State leaders game the system to change the proficiency levels so that all of a sudden school grades change wholesale. As a matter of fact, Bennett just did this recently in Florida, where he was embarrassed. He and his staff were embarrassed that there were over 250 schools that somehow flunked, many of whom had been C, A, B schools in the past. They decided to change the proficiency levels, and all of a sudden the number of schools that were flunking went down to just a little over 100.
So this doesn't sound anything to me about being about the children. I mean, I love the rhetoric. Oh, we care about the children. We want to make sure that they get an education and an opportunity. This doesn't sound anything like this. This sounds like a huckster trying to sell a product and an ideology, and will stop at nothing to prove that their ideas and their ideology is right. Kids be damned.
Well, the intention behind these grading systems, I agree, is very confusing, because if this is supposed to help children, then you would think that the system would be engineered to help the children that need to help the most through the system. But that's exactly the opposite of what is happening. The grading systems tend to penalize schools that have the lowest income students, schools that have the most amount of students who are in need of special education services, who struggle with the English language. And so what these grading systems do is they actually penalize those schools and tell them that, you know, that they're a failure, that they are in maybe in need of takeover or maybe in need of closing down, which we're now seeing in many urban centers across the country, such
Chicago.
As Philadelphia and Chicago
yep.
and New York City.
But I look at this, and I got to be honest, you know, I go back to this grading thing because I think I'm stuck on this. Is there no definition of what A through F is? Is there no hard, fast, this is what an A is? When I was a kid, this is what an A was. There was no gray area. There was no algorithm. There was no, a calculus. There was nothing that went into it. An A was an A. That was it. I don't know how you can make an argument that things fluctuate and that you can change it to fit different criteria. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, there are other ways to engineer these grading systems. One other method is that instead of using proficiency levels, which are also called, you know, academic achievement levels, you can use what's called performance levels, where you look at how the students in a given school have done in the past on standardized tests. And you can say, okay, here's how we expect these students, given on their past record, to do this next year. And then you test all the kids at the end of the year, and you look at the school and see, okay, did these students do better than what was expected? This is also called a value-added measurement. The problem with this approach, though, and as a matter of fact, I don't think there are many grading systems right now that use this to a great extent. But the problem with this approach, though, is that it's wildly statistically off-base. There sometimes it's only 33% to 50% accurate. So here again, you're not using a measure that is completely statistically valid. What is really needed at this point is for everybody to take a step back, stop assigning high-stakes consequences to these tests. Schools should not be closed down based on these grading systems. They should be given maybe some extra help. The grading system should be used as a sort of like a thermometer to just take a gauge. As a diagnostic tool, not as an evaluated tool.
I'm with you. You know, that's how I think most people think testing is. And, you know, when they had the high stakes tests here, in the state last year, my daughter, I chose to opt out because look, I wanted her out of that system, that game that is, I believe, rigged to make the schools fail anyway. So why put them through all of the pressure of these high-stakes tests only to have a situation where they're going to end up failing anyway? Because as of next year, on the testing side of it, 100% of the people have to be proficient in them next year, which to me sets up a situation where you're going to destroy the public schools anyway. And then we're going to end up in situations where you've got people like Bennett and people like Michelle Rhee, the rest of them who have this ideology of, you know, here's the next thing to privatize, the next franchise opportunity. This is where we're going to end up, Jeff.
Well, I think you bring up a really important point, is that if we know that these evaluation systems are flawed, and we do know that, then what's the intent here? Why are we assigning high stakes to them? We should look at what is going on, not just in the school evaluations, but also how teachers are being evaluated using these same sort of methodologies that we know are flawed. Research and scientific evidence shows that these methods are flawed. If why are they being rolled out? Why are legislators voting for them and promulgating them into law? This is going to be even a more significant issue in the very near future because we now have a new wave of standardized assessments being rolled out. They're tied to what is called the Common Core. And regardless of what you think of the Common Core, I don't want to get into that right now. regardless of what you think of it, these assessments are going to quite probably result in school systems across the country posting much lower scores on their state achievement tests. Kentucky was the first state where this happened. State scores dropped 30%. New York State, which will be reporting their scores tomorrow, educators have been warned that that score is going to drop 30%. This is going to be used as a tool from the people that you have mentioned, who are going to say, oh, there you go. These public schools are a failure. So we have to do something. We have to do something like, well, privatize them, shutter them all together and see what happens. And hopefully, you know, just by giving parents a choice, they'll somehow find a better avenue. So this problem is only going to get worse.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, and no one's been able to show me where the charters that they've set up and the cyber charters especially and all of the schools that they've been saying this is the answer, or they've actually worked. I mean, where you put in and you deal with the true problems of poverty and where you put in the resource and the time, I do believe, yeah, you can make a school better. But that's not what this is about. This is about, in my view, and you could disagree, but this is about sucking resource and sucking money out of this system so that the handfuls can collect more. And, well, you know, you kids in poverty, it came off your back.
Well, the public school sector in America is about $600 billion. So it's a nice, big, fat market to try to tap into. And at a time when we have a recessionary economy, and a fairly stagnant or low-growth population that's not producing a lot of big double-digit growth rates for large companies, it's not surprising that the Rupert Murdochs and other corporate entities of the world would try to make money off of public schools.
Yeah, well, last night I talked about this. I heard a commercial over the weekend for this franchise opportunity, Jeff. You can be a franchisee. You can start your own mathnasium. And for just $37,000 to the mathnasium people, you can start your own franchise. And Kiplinger back in 2011 wrote this, and you can't make this up, about mathnasium as a franchise opportunity. They said, with local school districts throughout the country trying to cut costs, parents are turning to outside sources to supplement their children's education. The private tutoring sector grew nearly 40% during the recession, demonstrating that parents will spend on their kids even during tough times. So it's a perfect entrepreneurial opportunity. We're gutting the public schools. We're starving them. And parents want the best for their kids. They're willing to dig deep. And, boy, you can cash in on it. For just $37,000 and 10% royalty, you can have your own mathnasium, Jeff.
Well, you know, and all this is being posed as some kind of more innovative way to educate children, as if human nature has somehow, you know, just transformed overnight, and that we've never known how to educate children until now, and that somehow public schools have held back on their good ideas, haven't even been trying to educate children. But you make a very good point that parents will dig deep. Because they understand that this is their children's future, and it's also the future of the country.
Yep.
And that's why parents will dig deep. And as a matter of fact, when they're asked in all surveys that have ever been taken, should schools get more money, the resounding conclusion from not just parents but voters across America is yes, our public schools deserve more money. And yet – somehow we've got a leadership. I know it's terrible in Pennsylvania where you are, but it's now rife throughout the country and even into the top levels in the federal government. It somehow has the idea that that doesn't matter, that parent voices, voters' voices don't matter. What matters is that we have to engineer the system to where we spend less on it. And we're doing this at a time when the needs are growing. Already now have almost one in four children in America living in poverty. the number of children who have special education needs and who have troubles with the English language continues to grow. We know that all those things complicate the education process, and that costs more.
Yep.
And yet we have a leadership that keeps telling us that, no, no, we can become more efficient, and somehow we can spend less on education.
We can just follow the corporate model.
There's no data to support any of that, yeah.
We just follow the corporate model. So last question, what do we do? I mean, what do people like me, what do parents do in the face of all this? Because, you know, the wave of anti-public education is right now, I think, overwhelming. Every time I turn on the radio or the TV or anywhere, I'm inundated with, oh, cyber charter and, oh, this school and this and that, and public schools are failing. What do you do?
I think one thing that parents and community members need to do everywhere is to understand that their local schools are a reflection of what they're willing to put into their community. And right now, communities are being robbed of the financial resources that they need. But there are still the human resources. There are still your voices and your participation. And even though there are moneyed interests that are taking aim at the public school system, and they do have a lot of money. We're talking about the richest and most powerful people in the world. They are few, and we are many. And we can speak out, and we can work with our local educators, talk to your teachers, talk to other members in your community, and speak out. Look at what's happening in Chicago. Look at what's happening in Philadelphia. There is what I call an education spring spreading across the country. It's happening even in places like North Carolina and Texas and in California that have not always had strong histories of vocal protesting. But people are pouring out into the streets. They are taking part in school board elections. They are contributing to political organizations that are going to fight for their public schools, because that's what we're going to have to do.
Yeah.
That's the only way we're going to keep this.
And as I said months ago, this is the hill that the working class of this country has to die on, because this is the opportunity to advance and to do better. Jeff Bryant, director of the Education Opportunity Network, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
Again, the website, educationopportunitynetwork.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Jeff Bryant's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
History. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about the science book. Don't know much about the French actor. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Tired of hearing nothing but the corporate news and views on commercial mass-market radio? Then get your own station. That's not as preposterous as it might sound. Thanks to a freelance, free-range, free-form collective of mostly young activists banded together as the Prometheus Radio Project. This nonprofit group arose in the past decade from the low-power FM pirate radio insurrection, consisting of local progressives who set up unlicensed stations that operate on only about 100 watts of power. Yes, a light bulb's worth. The signals of these renegade broadcasters have a range of up to 10 miles in diameter. enough to cover a town or urban neighborhood. They can create a very localized, democratic, and inexpensive micromedia, providing a way for communities to put their own voices, issues, music, and stories on the dial. But there was that outlaw factor, which allowed powerhouse corporate chains to dispatch the authorities to shut down the tiny units. Prometheus, however, battled the giants with a grassroots campaign to legalize and license low-power nonprofit stations. It took 10 years of uphill slogging, but their tenacious grassroots organizing paid off in 2011 when President Obama signed the Local Community Radio Act. With rules and staff now in place, thousands of low-power licenses will be put up for grabs by nonprofit community groups this October. But you must act quickly if your group wants one, for the window will only be open for 2 weeks in a sort of Oklahoma land rush of the air. Prometheus is now offering assistance to people interested in democratizing the dial and strengthening their communities with these low-watt, high-impact radio signals. This is Jim Hightower saying, so get radioactive. Go to Prometheus Radio Project pronto. That's PrometheusRadio.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
In Tony Bennett's fabric, I have an addiction to really pushing ed reform policy. I sometimes refer to it as my drug of choice.
But most of all, it's not fair to the children of Florida that I continue as commissioner.
Another one bites the dust.
It's his drug of choice. Yes, his drug of choice. Yeah, Tony Bennett. Not the real Tony Bennett, not the singer, not the 87-year-old singer. No, this is like a lot of these education reform people, I think con artists. And, you know, at the end of the day, what they're pushing for is they're pushing for for-profit education, bottom line. You know, like we talked about yesterday with the mathnasium and all of the business opportunities that are popping up because we have defunded public education. You're just going to see more of this. And I, over the weekend, I saw this ad for I think Strayer or Starver or some kind of, I think it was Strayer University, where, because one of the knocks against these for-profit universities, these online deals, is that you get into them and you never finish it. Their graduation rates are pathetic at best. And so they've got to figure out a way of, oh, you know, how do we get people to finish this stuff? So I saw this ad that said, well, we'll start a graduation fund for you. And it says, we'll cover up to 25% of your tuition. Our one-of-a-kind way of making a quality bachelor's degree more affordable. And you learn, click here to learn more. And I'm going, okay, well, let's see how much I can save. And they go, you could save up to $17,750. And I'm going, well, hold on. If I can save $17,000, that means an online degree, which doesn't hold an awful lot of credibility, $71,000 for a four-year degree without the housing, without the food, without any, it's online degree. $71,000? Really? And only if I finish, then I get the 25% back, maybe. And in the small print, it reads, if you take two consecutive quarters off, you could lose all of that. So I guess the idea is to keep you coming back even after you realize that it is a ripoff. Because, hey, you know, you've got time into it. You might as well try and get to the $17,750 payoff on the $71,000 online degree, which just kind of, you know, left me scratching my head going, you know, I know some of these online places. One of the struggles is if you start there, you can't transfer anywhere because no one will take their credits. And I know there's a couple of bills floating around Congress where they're trying to force everyone to take these credits. I gotta be honest with you, it's a ripoff. It seems to me to be like a ripoff, but it's what they did this, you know, a number of years back. The very wealthy said, hey, we can make these for-profit universities and we can bilk public dollars and the GI money and the student loan money. We could bilk people out of all this money and we could pay huge exorbitant sums to our executives. It'd be fantastic. And I've been saying for the longest time, this is what they want to do to K through 12. The exact same thing. And I've been saying for the longest time that eventually, you know, you're going to graduate from third grade with a student loan. Yay, I got my third grade certificate. Maybe I can go on to fourth if I can get the loan to do it. And you go, Rick, oh, you're being facetious, right? I saw this story from New York City. That kind of just made me go, am I missing something? City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, who is running for mayor, she unveiled what a pilot program on Monday to provide, I can't even believe this, they're going to provide loans to families to pay for child care. So you, to get through the pre-K program, you know, to get the, your three-year-olds getting through the pre, you could take out a loan. Parents with 2 to 4 children, they'll be able to receive loans of about $11,000, up to $11,000 at 6% interest. Now the people who are getting the loans, they have to make between $80,000 and $200,000, and they cannot have a credit score less than 620. Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff that could go along with that, but what if you made, you know, $79,000, but, you know, you needed that child care? No, not for you. Sorry. We've now evidently in New York described middle class as $80,000 to $200,000. Instead of saying, and this is what Democrats of the past used to do, and I understand, she's a Democrat, and probably going to end up being the next mayor of New York, possibly. A Democrat would say, well, how do we take that money and how do we make a program that everyone can benefit from so that kids get good quality child care and families have the security of knowing that they can go to work and their kids are taken care of? How do we do that on a public level? How do we make sure that it's, no, this is about who can afford it and who can take out loans. I wonder which bank is backing all of this. And I wonder if they give her any kickback. Just a question. The pilot program will only provide 40 families loans in the first year. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, it is Transportation Tuesday. We'll talk with our good friend Abe Amoros from the Laborers International Union. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, has put out a call for people to sign his petition urging Congress to act on the nearly 70,000 structurally deficient bridges in the country. He points out that right now there are more than 2,000 structurally deficient bridges in Ohio. And, you know, I'm not quite sure the number here in Pennsylvania, like 5,000, some astronomical number. He points out that every day our family and friends drive over these dangerous bridges, and every day there's a chance one will collapse. He writes, two collapsed recently and more will collapse if we don't do anything. So over at the Facebook page, the Rick Smith Facebook page, you know, it's right there. Please sign on to Sherrod Brown's petition, because, you know, to me, getting people back to work, investing in transportation and infrastructure right now should be a no-brainer. It's good for the economy. It's good for the country. It's good for business. Here to help talk about it a little bit more is our good friend Abe Amoros. He's the Pennsylvania Legislative Director with LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America. Abe, what do you think? Some money for infrastructure? Just a thought?
Well, it's just a thought, Rick. But, hey, who am I to say, you know? Simply because it's just a matter of time before a bridge collapses in Pennsylvania. So I'm going to be signing on to that petition because we have to have it done. I mean, look, we're playing a terrible numbers game here. And with every day that goes on without legislative inaction, we are risking a tragedy, something that we just cannot afford in this Commonwealth. And I just can't believe that the legislature continues to put this off and put this off. And September the 23rd is going to be a big day in terms of Pennsylvania, because it's the first day back for the fall legislative session. And if this bill isn't teed up, if Senate Bill 1 is not teed up to put that $2.5 billion back on the table and have it spent or have it passed so we can spend it, I think it's going to be a travesty. Right now, I know there's going to be hearings set up throughout the entire state by Senator John Rafferty, the chairman of the Transportation Committee, and some of his colleagues are teeing those up as we speak. And there has to be some critical mass and some momentum going into the fall, or else we're going to see another year of inaction. And if nothing gets done in the fall, Rick, nothing's going to get done next year either, because it's an election year and these guys and gals don't have the backbone or the spine to get anything done. So something has to happen, and I hope that the bill passes before a bridge collapses.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, a little earlier in the program, we talked with Senator Jim Furlow, who said, you know, the Senate has done their work. All of this seems to be based around the House.
Right.
Terzai and Madcow and the rest of them seem to be hell-bent on there being no transportation bill. Why is that?
Well, Mike Terzai, the majority leader, has just shown to be the most inept majority leader in the history of Pennsylvania. And what he did, Rick, is he held the bill hostage for the privatization of the state stores. So it was booze over bridges instead of getting something done. And, you know, we just cannot have that kind of leadership in Pennsylvania. So what he did was he picked a fight with the Senate. The Senate didn't budge. The Senate did its job. They passed that bill 45-5, Rick. 45-5. It was a no-brainer in the Senate. It should be a no-brainer in the House. But that inept leadership over there just is unable to get anything done. And, you know, you point at the ineptitude of the House, and you point at the ineptitude of the Republicans, and then you look at the governor's numbers in the tank at 24%, and you wonder how anything gets done in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, for me, you look at this whole scenario, and as a voter, I'm of the mindset, you know, all of these people in leadership, they got to go. I mean, to me, what you laid out, the tying booze to bridges, to me, just sounds dumb. Because to me, fixing the roads and bridges should not be a partisan thing. Look, I get the ideological divide over should the state control and sell wine and spirits, or should it be the profiteers? I get that ideological divide. I don't see an ideological divide of, am I going to survive from this side of the bridge to the other? I don't see that.
That's exactly right, Rick. This should not be a partisan issue at all. This has everything to do with common sense solutions to bring the Commonwealth into the 21st century in terms of its infrastructure. And truth be told, the labor unions and even the Chamber of Commerce are on the same side on this one. The Chamber understands that in order to have efficient business running in Pennsylvania, you have to have good roads and structurally efficient bridges in Pennsylvania as well to move the products and the goods, and so we can have the businesses purring as they should be, rather than having all of this traffic and congestion. And, you know, time is money. And so for as long as we can put our heads together here with labor at one side, with business at the other, I mean, it's a perfect storm.
Yeah.
And we're blowing it. I mean, we're just missing out on it. And the only guys that are slowing this down are the Republican members of the House of Representatives. And no one can get through to Leader Terzai. And I just don't understand why he continues to do this, why he continues to be so stubborn, and why the governor has been absolutely unable to move that body. It's just amazing.
That is amazing. Yeah, I've been reading some of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission's annual report here on traffic and congestion. And, you know, they point out that I-83 during rush hour, the average speed from rush hour is 34 miles an hour, half of what it typically is on the highway. And the 83-81 split tied up. In fact, they point out that at its peak, you know, a driver would take it six times longer to travel I-83 than under normal conditions. Six times as long. And I go, you know, me, one, we should be expanding. Two, public transportation. Get people off the roads. Even if you're not taking the bus or the train or whatever, somebody else is going to.
That's exactly right, Rick. Money is time, and that kind of congestion just is a terrible thing, because what you're doing is you're stifling productivity. You're stifling efficiency. And like you said, people are going to be taking public transportation as well. And so none of this makes any sense whatsoever. And, you know, I don't have the patience to sit in traffic. I don't know about you, but nope. I certainly don't have the patience to sit in traffic, especially going 35 miles an hour in a 60-mile-an-hour zone. But more importantly, the safety issue is what really bothers me, Rick. I mean, any day now, we are poised to have a major catastrophe. And what's going to happen then? Are they going to call a special session? Are they finally going to get off their duffs and do something productive? I mean, do we really have to wait for it to get that bad that we have to, wait for a calamity to occur?
Well, I mean, take this how you have to. It happens, and it has to happen, I hope it's one of them, and it's not someone who had no choice in this matter.
Let me tell you. I mean, I get frustrated, and I'm a little tongue-tied, because I just cannot. I mean, the more I think about this, Rick, the angrier I get. There is absolutely no reason why we should be sitting here in August talking about why a transportation bill was not passed.
I have a theory, because I was thinking about this this afternoon, and I have a friend from my past, you know, years ago I used to work with, who was a gambling addict. And he had, And I was thinking about this today. We have so many needs. How do you prioritize what needs come first? We obviously don't have the money. We've got numerous bridges that are insufficient, that are structurally deficient, whatever. And he used to have a Bill Kitty. And a pair of dice in the box, and he would number all of his bills, and he would roll the dice, you know, to pay his bills. I think the state's run by much like my friend Doug, who had his Bill Kitty, and that's how we're doing our transportation and our investing. We've got a road kitty, and we're rolling the dice every day.
Well, it certainly appears that way, and it's really not the best way to run the Commonwealth. Public safety has to trump everything else. Infrastructure has to trump everything else. And you know what's been lost here, Rick, is the fact that we're not talking about the kind of jobs that this is going to create. I don't mean you. I don't mean your listeners. I'm talking about others. Even the legislators have not done a very good job talking about the economic benefits of passing a comprehensive infrastructure bill. For every $1 billion, and I think we talked about this before, Rick, for every $1 billion of investment, you're looking at 42,000 jobs. That's a lot of jobs to get a lot of our guys and gals off the bench and working and providing for their families. But, you know, just like you said, they're rolling the dice. Bad things are going to happen eventually because it is a numbers game. And the longer we go without fixing our roads and bridges, the greater the chances are that something calamitous is going to take place.
Yep. The longer you gamble, the more chance you got to lose. You know, last question I've got for you then. Who do we scream at? Who do we hold accountable for this? Whose office do we call in the morning? What do we do?
What we really need to do is flood the offices of Representative Mike Terzai, the majority leader. Tell him that action needs to take place immediately. It has to be the number one legislative priority on Monday morning, September the 23rd. And there should be nothing else on the table until a comprehensive transportation bill is passed, $2.5 billion to fix our roads and bridges in Pennsylvania and to put thousands, tens of thousands of people back to work, Rick.
I'm right there with you. Abe, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our good friend Abe Amoros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for LIUNA. Quick break, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in Labor's Forgotten Massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer Massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, I think about, I was just remembering my friend Doug, who really had a horrible gambling problem. I mean, he would go on payday on Friday and buy the following Monday. Most of it was whatever his wife couldn't wrangle out of his hands would be lost. And the Bill Kitty thing, I still remember it because he used to joke about, well, you know, I only got to roll the dice twice this paycheck to pay bills. And I think about that as, you know, as a state strategy. Think of all of the roads and all of the bridges that need repair and all of the opportunity for disaster. And to go home over the summer, to leave your job, to abandon your job half done, to me seems almost criminal. And I got to be honest, you know, when I look at this and you go, okay, hold on. Let's say someone does get killed on the roadways. Do they get to sue these people for not doing their job, for negligence, for not passing a bill that's going to fix those roads and bridges? I mean, at some level, you've got to look and you go, who's to be held accountable? And now the Republicans, well, it was the Democrats' fault. The Democrats, it was their fault. They did it. Understand this, folks. The Democrats don't have to show up to work. It's not like the Republicans ask for their input or take their input. Republicans have steamroller power. There shouldn't be a question. Things should just be done, and done their way, obviously, right? Well, they believe in, you know, their ideology, privatize the roads. They should have steam. They have absolute control, absolute power. There's no opposition. There's no, oh, we need to negotiate with the other side or consider what the other side says. No, there's none of that. There's right-wing ideology. We're going to run this Commonwealth into the ground. Only they're doing it by not doing anything. I mean, it's really, really very amazing to me that nothing is getting done. I mean, the state's kind of on autopilot. You know, the non-political people show up every day. They do their jobs. They come in. They do what they're supposed to do. They know it's the system's set up. The wheels are still moving right along. But any improvements, any moving forward, anything? Zip, man. And I think it speaks volumes that they're not there hammering out this transportation bill, which I think everybody wants. Or at least everybody who's going to be on that bridge that collapses. And for me, again, as Abe pointed out, 42,000 jobs for every $1 billion we invest. What kind of a reverberation effect would that have through our economy? Now, then Corbett could say, hey, I'm the more jobs governor. But, you know, the numbers are he's had a net growth of 1,000 jobs in the last 12 months. 49th in the country. When he took office, we were 7th in job creation. We are now 49th. Whatever you think it is, whatever, you know, he's the guy who's on the watch. He's the guy who's good, bad, and different. He's the one taking the responsibility because it's on his watch. And I love the Fox News little bullet point. Oh, Pennsylvania created 100,000 jobs since January of 2009 when Corbett wasn't governor for two of those years. And those 2 years were pretty decent. We were 7th. The last year, 49th. So it kind of makes me, you know, go step back and go, the guy who's calling himself the more jobs governor, and you add the caveat of more than Wyoming, okay, so you're the more than Wyoming jobs governor. I get it. But to not have a transportation bill where you could go, you know what, I can create upwards of 100,000 jobs almost immediately by investing in making the Commonwealth better so that we can attract business. Because as I said last night when we were talking about the Dow Chemical plant, comes down to 5 points. Location, 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 education, transportation. Pretty simple. We've got the location. We've got all three of those. The Dow Chemical guy said, hey, you got some of the best education, higher education facilities in the country. That's why we're here. The brains are here. The skills, they're here. Even though our governor has done what he can to defund that even. And then there's infrastructure. There's transportation. There are the roads and the bridges, which they've done everything they can do to not improve. So when they say they want to bring jobs to the Commonwealth, don't you have to question? Don't you have to think that, you know, okay, well, if education and infrastructure are that important, let's see what they've done. Well, on the education front, he cut $2 billion from education over the past 3 years. $2 billion. 21,000 education professionals to the curb. On infrastructure, still, even though his commission says we need $3.5 billion over the next couple of years, nothing, nothing. Does that sound like a guy who wants to create jobs? I mean, really, stop and think about it. Just get away from he's a Republican, and get away from, you know, people view me as someone who sides with Democrats. I'm a guy who wants to get things done. I want to get the roads fixed. I want to get people back to work. I want to get some investment. I want to get things moving in the right direction. And to me, the transportation is a no-brainer. It shouldn't even be something that politics ever enters into. But we live in this era where, oh, well, my team's going to win. While the rest of us are going, well, what do we win? We win potholes. We win deficient bridges. We win the opportunity to fall into the drink if the bridge collapses. I don't like that opportunity. Which is why I think we need to be voting these bums out next time around. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republicans who control the U.S. House are trying for the 40th time to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Protect Your Care and Americans United for Change are launching efforts to counteract the GOP attack on health care reform. Americans United for Change's Brad Woodhouse.
Protect Your Care and Americans United for Change are combining forces to manage an aggressive national communications and rapid response hub here in Washington, which will highlight how the law is currently helping Americans, how it will benefit millions more Americans in the future, and how Republicans would undermine the health security of Americans by repealing it.
Woodhouse says if Republicans ever do succeed at repealing the Affordable Care Act, it would let insurance companies return to bad policies that hurt health care consumers.
Insurance industry could again deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, including for pregnancy. It could again discriminate based on gender. Again, insurance companies can impose large premium increases in co-pays for preventive care. Insurance companies would no longer have to keep young people on the plans of their parents till they turn 26.
Even as progressives rally to defend the Affordable Care Act, labor unions remain very concerned about the impact the law will have on existing health care plans negotiated by unions. Among the concerns is a 40% tax on so-called Cadillac health plans, plans that cost more than $10,200 for individuals or $27,500 for families. Many public employee health plans could be near that threshold when the tax takes effect in 2018. There also will be no subsidies for Taft-Hartley multi-employer health plans jointly administered by unions and employers. Unions are also worried that employers will scale back hours to part-time to avoid providing health benefits under the reform. The unions say these issues can be fixed by the Obama administration as the law is implemented. They are working to persuade the White House to address the problems. The North Carolina NAACP and the Forward Together movement took Moral Mondays to the mountains Monday with a rally in Asheville. North Carolina NAACP President Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II says with the legislature out of session, Moral Mondays in North Carolina's capital have been suspended after drawing 10,000 people last week. More than 800 people have been arrested in civil disobedience actions at Moral Mondays, protesting what the NAACP says are the extremist policies of the GOP-controlled state legislature. Here's Reverend Barber during a speech at an earlier Moral Monday rally.
Somehow, through the storm, we're going to make it. Somehow, through this crazy legislature, we're going to make it. Somehow, through the money, we're going to make it. We're going forward. And there's one thing we're not going to do. We are not going back. We are not going back.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Well, we'll see. The auction's still going on. Is the housing market, well, is it recovering? Some say yes, some say no. But Obama gave a speech today from Phoenix, Arizona. Not much in my view new. Maybe the we're going to get rid of Freddie and Fannie. Kind of an appeasing the right wing. Not quite sure how that's going to work out. But, you know, the theme of the better bargain came up again. And I guess it's better than the grand bargain. Personally, I would prefer we talk about collectively bargaining, but that's completely seems to be off the radar. Here to talk about the big speech today from Phoenix, Arizona, I've got David Day, and he is a contributing writer over at Salon. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So what did you think of the big speech today?
Well, like you said, there wasn't a whole lot new in there other than this endorsement of a Senate bill, a sort of a quasi-endorsement of Corker Warner, which would wind down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and create something basically that's not called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac but is exactly the same thing. So it's not really much of a big difference, and it's predicated on some really dodgy assumptions about whether or not investors would just love to get back into one of the most corrupt markets that has ever been created in the last 70 years, which is the mortgage-backed security private market, which, you know, gets, there are lawsuits almost every day. In fact, 30 minutes before the speech, the Justice Department sued Bank of America for misrepresentations to investors on a mortgage-backed security in 2008. and they think investors are going to somehow, you know, line up to buy this product again without a government guarantee, it's just nonsense.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking. I'm going, you know, who's going to take it over and who's going to put the money in and how much of our money are we going to have to guarantee and how much sweetener is going to have to be along in this? You know, I go back to something, Donna Cooper, who was, in the Rendell administration here in Pennsylvania told me about when, they wanted to privatize the turnpike. The moneyed interests they wanted just not enough money to make money off of the privatization of the turnpike. They wanted what they would have made anywhere else. So they were just going to pull a number out of the air and say, this is what we'd have made anywhere else, and this is what you have to pay us. And I see this as kind of the same scenario. They're going to come out with some wild number, and that's what we're willing to do this for.
Well, I mean, you think about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They have a portfolio of $4.2 trillion in mortgages right now. And if you wind them down, suddenly someone is going to have to back that paper and do the continuing secondary mortgage market that creates kind of the liquidity so that people have enough capital that they can float loans out, as if the banks don't have enough money to float loans otherwise. But anyway, that's an entirely different matter. But, you know, $4 trillion, where is that coming from? I mean, they're going to line up funds, public pension funds, that's a big institutional investor, other state municipal funds and things of that nature, and lead them back into the slaughter like cows into an abattoir. I don't understand why any investor would be given the bargain of, here, come into this market where you were lied to about the quality of the securities, and then given back pennies on the dollar when you said that these banks who issued you the securities violated the contract. And also, you're going to take the first losses up to 10% on anything because we're not doing bailouts anymore. And, oh, yeah, you can get private mortgage insurance to insure you against losses. But all of those private mortgage insurers, when there was a downturn during the financial crisis, went out of business. And the ones that didn't were basically backdoor bailout. It was a backdoor bailout by Fannie and Freddie, who were getting rid of. So that's your bargain. you as an investor have a lot of places to put your money, but for some reason there's this assumption in Washington that the private market's just going to be there to prop up the mortgage industry, like they assume, you know, the Economist story. They assume a can opener when they're on a desert island, and that's how they open the can. That's kind of what it's like. They're just assuming that there's $4 trillion floating around somewhere that's just going to love to get involved in the most corrupt market of the last 70 years.
So I take it you don't think it's going to work.
I kind of don't. And I, you know, obviously we're in a situation now where Fannie and Freddie own or guarantee about 87% of all mortgages in the United States. That's a precarious situation. It probably sets us up for another bailout if the market turns back down. So something does need to be done, but the things that are on the menu are really just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Right. I don't understand why there seems to be no logic behind it. And it's really just preserving this market that completely failed in 2007 and 2008. It caused the run-up through this securitization machine that fueled the housing bubble, and then it completely crashed, caused a global recession that we're still crawling our way out of. So why would we want to preserve that kind of market just so rich people can get cheap loans and get a lot of money off in their mortgage interest deduction?
Well, they learned their lesson.
Regressive.
They learned their lesson. They wouldn't do it again. They promise.
They learned their lesson, exactly.
I mean, isn't that what we heard back in 1999 when they were ramming through Gramm-Leach-Bliley and all of the changes and destroying Glass-Steagall, that the Depression could never happen because the banking industry learned their lesson from the Depression and would never make those mistakes again?
Right, and those, of course, have to be backed up with both rules and enforcement. And the rules have been mixed. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau does exist now. They have some pretty good rules on the origination of mortgages. But even they said this week that even though they have rules in place to block mortgage brokers from steering homeowners into higher cost loans that make more profits for them, even though those rules are in place, that the lenders are still doing. Yeah. And they took one to court, in fact. So without enforcement, rules don't mean much of anything. And some of the rules that have been created just really are irrelevant. I mean, the servicing rules, which your mortgage servicer is the entity you interface with when that you pay your monthly payment to, and they have all sorts of bad incentives, and they value foreclosures over loan modifications if you get into trouble, and their compensation model has not changed a bit, and they still have all these wonky incentives that can get struggling borrowers into a lot of trouble. So, you know, they learn their lesson, maybe, but without enforcement and without very clear rules, we're just setting ourselves up for yet another crisis.
Only with banks that are now too big to fail and situations that are even bigger than they were before. And
I said
when the collapse happened that this is an opportunity to go back and undo some of this consolidation, break these up. And I point to the Bank of North Dakota, who seems to be doing pretty well. I mean, they're making loans to small businesses. They're making loans to homeowners. They seem to have weathered the storm fairly well. Is that not the model that we should be looking to? I mean, if this was a better bargain, isn't a better bargain smaller, more functional, more, if we love competition, more competitive banks?
Well, certainly a better bargain is not the same kind of go-go mortgage market that we saw run up this giant bubble that crashed and collapsed the global economy. I mean, there just doesn't seem to be any kind of ingenuity coming out of Washington in terms of just simple common sense, thinking, look, we got us into a lot of trouble with this system the first time. Let's not recreate it 100%. And let's think of a different way, and let's not encourage massive subsidies on home ownership when it's a completely volatile asset and it's not as good a wealth building tool as, say, you know, creating a basic income, for example, or so many other things that you could do with the money of the mortgage interest deduction or the money subsidizing mortgage-backed securities, which is basically what this winding down of Fannie and Freddie would cause.
Yeah.
So there are just a lot of different ways that you could think about this thing supporting renting. I know that Obama mentioned that today, in the same breath he said that home ownership was the American dream and everyone deserves a chance at home ownership. And that is exactly what got us into trouble in the first place.
Yeah,
So
I don't know that the American dream is so much owning a home, but having a home.
Stay in it.
Exactly.
I mean,
that's the American dream, having a place to hang your hat. And, you know, the home ownership thing to me came about more later, the 80s, 90s than my grandparents' generation. You know, they eventually owned their home, but for years they rented.
Yeah. I mean, it was the ownership society of George W. Bush, right? This idea that if you had a stake in the country through ownership, that would somehow bring us along. The truth is that there was no ownership. It was basically renting on a much more dangerous scale because you had all these interest only loans, yep, and negative amortization loans. There was no ownership really involved. It was just rent extraction, from banks that were predatory. And it got homeowners and our economy into a ton of trouble. So we need to rethink this and come up with a way to preserve stable communities, you know, thinking of it along those lines rather than simply the sort of hammer of promoting home ownership.
Yeah, I remember back, you know, when all the very interesting loan products were floating around. I actually saw at one point a 50-year mortgage that some were trying. And my favorite one was the 125% mortgage. Yes, we'll give you up to 125% of the value of your home. And I'm going, wait a second. I'm going to take out a loan and I'm already not only in debt for the value of the house, but 25% more? And I look at the speech today and I said, there was nothing in there about what I think has to happen, which is principal reduction, where you have to start bringing some of this stuff down for the people who got screwed in this situation.
Right. There was nothing in there about sort of resetting the market. There was this nod towards refinancing, which, you know, most people who are looking for a home know that mortgage rates have gone up quite a bit over the last 2 months, and the plans are for them to go up quite a bit more. So refinancing into a lower cost loan, that loan suddenly isn't as low as it was. You add on the closing costs, and going from a 6% to a 4.5% loan doesn't sound like such a good bargain, really. And they're claiming that you can save $3,000 a year with this, you know, if you open up refinancing to more borrowers. Those are old numbers, and that's not true anymore. There does need to be, especially in these hard-hit communities, more interest in refinancing. You know, Richmond, California has this very interesting eminent domain idea, which is sort of a local principal reduction idea. There's a company called Boston Community Capital, which is a company that goes in, buys these loans, and sells them back to the owner at a market rate. And they make their money on through getting venture capital and making their money on the normal course of interest throughout the life of the loan. So there are other options here, that would take the worst communities that are still suffering and help them, along with refashioning this mortgage industry, the largest market in the world, the residential U.S. housing market, in such a way to make it a lot less risky, a lot less volatile, and a lot less prone to fraud. And there are ways to do that, but that's not really what we got today.
That's not what we got today. So let me ask you a last line of questioning, because, mm-hmm. you know, I had someone say to me that, well, you know, he's trying to get something passed, and maybe this is what the Republicans will go for. Personally, I think the Republicans go for nothing. I think they're going to leave him out to dry until 2014, in the hopes that they can take the Senate back and force a bunch of things down his throat. But what are your thoughts that you know, this is the olive branch. This is him trying to reach across the aisle and pass something.
Well, House Republicans have a bill, and it's far more punitive. They have no role for the government in mortgage finance whatsoever. And, in fact, the House Republican bill includes a provision that would legalize sort of magically any document that banking companies put out.
Nice.
In order to foreclose on something. It would sort of codify this private electronic database that has taken over our property record system in the United States. So there are a lot of really right-wing ideas in the Republicans' version of this bill, which is set to pass the House probably sometime in September. So, you know, for Obama to endorse a process that's going on in the Senate between a couple Republicans and a couple Democrats, you know, he endorsed the immigration bill that Republicans and Democrats passed in the Senate, and that seems like it's DOA in the House. So I don't feel like he's you know, putting something out there that really has a chance of getting passed. I would have to assume that this is his actual sentiment of what we should do in the housing market, and I just think that there was room for a lot bolder thinking there.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm not thrilled hearing that, because there was part of me that was hoping that was the case. He was trying to reach out, because, you know, if you know nothing's going to get passed, then you go out there and you're bold and you're pushing the goalposts and you're pushing new ideas. This just seemed very limp to me today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're not as stymied. I mean, housing is an issue where there are executive branch options here. I mean, we still have, I believe, $50 billion that was committed through TARP for housing-related programs, and I think to date, less than $15 billion of that has actually been spent. So
why is that? I mean, if the money's there, this is what infuriates me.
It should. You know, it absolutely should.
This should have been spent in 2009 and 2010.
No question. And the problem is that HAMP, which was the big system here, and by the way, 4 years ago, HAMP was announced in Phoenix, and it's actually a little insulting that the president came back 4 years later at the site where he inaugurated this basically a predatory lending program that was completely at the discretion of the mortgage servicers and which they used to trap borrowers and push them into foreclosure. It's a little shocking that he would return to the scene of that crime. But, you know, HAMP was a system that was completely discretionary on the lenders to decide whether or not they would do mortgage modifications. And because the incentives financially were towards foreclosure and not modifications, they didn't take the very puny incentives that were given to them by the government because, you know, that HAMP money, that was paid to the servicer. That wasn't paid to the individual. It was paid to the servicer to incentivize them to make these modifications. But it wasn't enough money to offset the incentives that servicers already had built in to foreclose on people. So that's the core problem there. But that money still exists. It still could be allocated. We don't need John Boehner to agree. We don't need Mitch McConnell to agree. It's an executive branch program. They could do things with the money. They aren't.
Jeez. That just makes me even angrier, David. David Day and I appreciate the time, contributing writer over at Salon.com. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK.
1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Tired of hearing nothing but the corporate news and views on commercial mass-market radio? Then get your own station. That's not as preposterous as it might sound. Thanks to a freelance, free-range, free-form collective of mostly young activists banded together as the Prometheus Radio Project. This nonprofit group arose in the past decade from the low-power FM pirate radio insurrection, consisting of local progressives who set up unlicensed stations that operate on only about 100 watts of power. Yes, a light bulb's worth. The signals of these renegade broadcasters have a range of up to 10 miles in diameter, enough to cover a town or urban neighborhood. They can create a very localized, democratic, and inexpensive micromedia, providing a way for communities to put their own voices, issues, music, and stories on the dial. But there was that outlaw factor, which allowed powerhouse corporate chains to dispatch the authorities to shut down the tiny units. Prometheus, however, battled the giants with a grassroots campaign to legalize and license low-power nonprofit stations. It took 10 years of uphill slogging, but their tenacious grassroots organizing paid off in 2011 when President Obama signed the Local Community Radio Act. With rules and staff now in place, thousands of low-power licenses will be put up for grabs by nonprofit community groups this October. But you must act quickly if your group wants one, for the window will only be open for Oklahoma land rush of the air. Prometheus is now offering assistance to people interested in democratizing the dial and strengthening their communities with these low-watt, high-impact radio signals. This is Jim Hightower saying, so get radioactive. Go to Prometheus Radio Project pronto. That's PrometheusRadio.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
In fact, I was in a meeting in Wall Street, Rick, and it was a pretty stunning meeting because we were talking with them about, you know, how can we get more private investment in infrastructure? And they said, pay us, and you have to pay us not just the cost of the capital, like, you know, $60 million to rebuild I-80. You got to pay us for the profit that we would lose by putting that money elsewhere.
No, I look at this, and, you know, they're very well-to-do. They always do very well. They game the system to where they never lose. And this home, this mortgage thing is the exact same thing. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past couple of years. And, you know, I go back to, you know, a guy I met who I had some interesting conversations, who spent the mass of his life as a bank president. And he talked to me about, and he's been retired for, you know, quite a number of years. And he said, you know, he got out of it when it really changed. And it happened right around the same time as Graham Leach Bliley and the end of the Clinton term, when, you know, the corporatists really had their tentacles in throughout the Clinton administration and the Republicans. And they were all, while they were fighting on the surface, underneath, the corporatists, they were in charge. And he said, you know, when the banking industry changed from can you afford to buy this home and will you be able to pay us back, is it something that long term you're going to be beneficial for both of us? That changed from that mentality to how much is the property worth and how much will it be worth when we get it back? And one of the things that, you know, in talking with David there, you know, I remember that 125% mortgage, because there were those who believed that, you know, it was never going to stop. It was going to keep growing and growing, and the property values would keep going up and up and up, because, you know, markets were tight. You had a growing demographic. You had people who were buying houses. There were more. So, you know, supply and demand, basic laws. And then it was never going to end. So if you took out a loan and you bought a house and you took out a 125% mortgage, you got to take that 25% extra and you could be a tycoon and you could do something else with that money. Because this is what rich people get away with. Understand that. You know, this isn't something that was just dreamt up. This is what rich people do. They don't use their own money. They use other people's money to buy stuff. You know, it's amazing the schemes that the very well-to-do get away with, because they lobby for them. They get these loopholes. They get what they want because they have the resource. And they've sold us. And this is one of those things that, you know, sends me back a little bit, because, you know, they've sold us on this idea that we can all be the investor class. We can all be wealthy. We can all be, you know, Bill Gates or whatever. So they say, here's this chance, here's this trick. And I remember a friend bought a house and they had no money down. And the house was $77,000, and I remember that because, you know, it just stuck in my head. And they offered $87,000 for the house in the hopes that the homeowner would take a big percentage of it, give it back to put down as closing, at closing cost, as a down payment. Then what they did is and this is the kind of stuff that was commonplace before the crash. Then they took out a 30-year loan, for 80% of the mortgage, of the mortgaged money, so they could get away with not paying private mortgage insurance. So they took out 80% for 30 years at a certain interest rate, and then they took out the other 20% for 10 years at a much higher interest rate. So that if you made it the 10 years, you could probably make it. But she was never going to make it the 10 years. And what my banking friend said is, look, you know, in years past, they would have never done that because they set you up to fail in those first 10 years. If you made it past the 10 years, a big if, then you could probably make it. What they were looking at is, okay, they got their money. The house value is worth X amount. You know, they know in 5 years you'll be able to sledge along. They're going to get most of their money back at interest right in the first 5 years because mortgages are front-end interest loaded. Then they take the property back. And in 5 years, the value will have gone up, and they'll be able to sell it off to the next sucker who gets into the same kind of scenario. Not thinking that there were so many of these situations that they had put people into it. And it's not because they were, the people were greedy or because they were stupid or because, you know, they, it wasn't that. These are hardworking people who bought the, I can have a slice of the American dream. I can own this house. And the bank, who I trust, is telling me that I can do this, that I can afford this, that they believe that I'm a good investment. And I remember her telling me this. Well, if the bank didn't think I could pay it back, they wouldn't give it to me. And I go, I don't know about that. And you go down the line, you look at this, and you go, how many millions of people did that happen to? Which then, by having this situation, ended up bringing almost everybody down with them. Because you had bad actors, and you had, from the federal level, bad law, bad policy, bad regulations, all pushed for by who? The same exact people who crashed the economy during the Depression. And the same people that we're enriching today. That's the thing that infuriates me. And now we're hearing the same things. Oh, well, they learned their lesson. They won't do it again. Until, obviously, the next time, right? And I point to the Bank of North Dakota, who did very well during the collapse. Because they kept the mentality of, can you afford it? They stuck to the mentality that they're a local bank who is invested in the local community. And as this banker friend of mine said, you know, in the past, like when my grandparents' generation bought houses, you bought a house from the guy at the local bank. The guy at the local bank gave you the loan. You knew the guy at the local bank. They knew you. You had your checking account, you had your savings account. They knew your hat. They knew you. And if you had problems, you walked into the bank, you met with the guy who probably wrote you the loan, and you said, hey, I'm struggling a little bit. Can we work something out? And things got worked out. Now, you listen to the stories, and we've had hundreds of people on this program over the last couple of years who have told the story of, well, the bank, first thing the call center person told me to do was stop making my payments. Which right away, to me, is a huge red flag going, wait a minute. What, I need to get behind on my loan before you, I'm telling you, I'm struggling. I've got to get so many months behind before you'll help? It sounds like a setup. And as we found out, it was. Millions of people lost their homes. And the sad part about this is that the banks didn't move those houses to someone else. Most of them are sitting abandoned. And that's pulling down neighborhoods, and which is why I'm glad to see communities across the country going, you know what, enough already. We're going to take them back. I'm a big fan of using eminent domain. If I say if the bank can't move it in 6 months, honestly, if you can't move it in 6 months, we take it. And you will get market value, and that's it. Whatever the market bears, we'll auction it off. And whatever the auction gets, that's what you get. That's what we should be doing. You want to see some motivated sellers then? You want to see some banks going, uh-oh, we better get rid of this huge inventory? To me, crisis ended. But we didn't see that today. And I got to be honest, I was quite disappointed with the speech. The president threw a little bit of rhetoric towards affordable, low-cost rental housing, which I think we should be doing on a national level, especially when you look at the fact that, you know, you've got all of these low-wage industries which seem to dominate our economy. But understand, the Republicans are never going to come along. Never. Which is why they need to go. and with a good number of Democrats as well. I would love to see another party spring up, a working class, you know, just do away with the Republicans and call them the Democrats, and let's start with something else. That seems reasonable. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Interesting decision out of the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New York today. They reversed the decision last August it was, that U.S. District Judge Jack Weinstein in Brooklyn set aside a verdict, a guilty verdict, of a guy who was having a little Texas Hold'em type game, you know, just bringing in some few friends, little social networking in a big warehouse somewhere, but evidently violated the Illegal Gambling Business Act of 1970, which says, you know, you can't run a business for more than 30 days or earn more than $2,000 a day. So had to be fairly lucrative for Lawrence DeChristina to end up in going to jail. Well, one judge said no, threw it out. Well, the second Circuit Court of Appeals said no, that's not a game of skill. It's gambling. Kicked it back to the same guy who said it wasn't for sentencing. Now DeChristina faces up to 10 years in prison. I wonder if he could play the judge double or nothing on the sentencing. Who knows? Anyway, I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service, on the line. Justin, what do you think? Poker, is it a game of chance? Is it a game of skill? Both, what is it?
Well, whenever I play, it's a game of chance, because if I, win anything at all, I'm pretty lucky.
Yeah, for me, it's a game of, here's my money. Go ahead.
Pretty much, yeah. It's not even a game. It's just a fad. Sad state of affairs.
Yeah, so I find it interesting that there was a court that at one point who said, no, yeah, fine. Must be a poker fan himself. Let's get to the news. Yemen, what's going on?
Well, there is a big national security issue going on over there. In preparation for what has been some pretty reliable chatter coming through the intelligence community, it looks like the State Department has urged all U.S. citizens in the country to leave immediately. We are also seeing some defense personnel being taken out, primarily those who are in the Air Force. And this comes as embassies across the Middle East are being shuttered in anticipation for a possible attack. It looks like there was some high-level chatter that was intercepted between the Pakistani branch of al-Qaeda and the Yemeni branch, wherein the Pakistani branch was ordering the Arabian Peninsula branch to carry out an attack as soon as last Sunday. So it looks like that threat still exists, even though obviously last Sunday went off without a hitch. And, you know, people all across the Middle East and in the U.S., for that matter, if you go on the metro right now, it's pretty heavily locked down, are on their toes.
So if we had the color coding system like we had in Bush during the Bush years, would we be at code red? Would we be right up there at the top?
You know, I actually was talking about that the other day, and thankfully we got rid of that system because it looks like we would be. You know, there have been a number of people on the Hill who have been saying that this is the most reliable rumors that they have heard in quite some time. You know, Peter King, who's usually one to kind of play politics, or at least not a stranger to it, especially considering he is, you know, possibly mulling a 2016 run, said that this is a legitimate threat. And, you know, even somebody in D.C. who sort of knows a lot of people in the intelligence community, this is, you know, something that seems quite real. This has been something that they have been talking about for quite some time since June. A large array of, you know, DNI employees and whatnot have had their travel schedule blocked off for the entirety of July. So it looks like this is something that is being taken very seriously.
As it should be. But, you know, I look at the messaging coming out from the from the extreme right, to, pointing to Obama, saying, well, this is because we're on the run now. It's because you're weak. And I'm going, well, I don't know that I'm going there with you. I mean, I'm not a huge Obama fan either, but, I mean, I don't know about that.
Well, I mean, it's ridiculous. It looks like, you know, if anything, it's all due caution. And we know that a lot of these same people will be accusing the administration of not giving enough proper warning if the embassies were attacked. So it looks like they're, you know, trying to present a situation like we saw under Bush, wherein a lot of lawmakers did not feel like they were adequately informed. A lot of the public felt a little bit betrayed not to know that there was that warning saying bin Laden determined to attack within the U.S. And the travel advisory that we saw seems to give a more kind of a, it's a little vague, but at least it's a fair, honest warning, saying that there is an attack that it looks likely, and it will either emanate from or occur in the Arabian Peninsula.
Yeah, I mean, generally when the government says get out, I think that's probably a good sign that you should probably get out.
Yeah, that would be a pretty good sign. It looks like they are giving people in the country a fair shake. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, since apparently the chatter that was intercepted did not mention specific locations, but nevertheless, people are on their toes.
Now, what channels did they find this chatter, or don't we know? I mean, there's been an awful lot of talk about the NSA, you know, snooping into people's phone records. You know, tell me about it. Any word on how they found it?
I think the sources that revealed it were essentially just defense officials, but I believe this is likely coming from either the NSA or the DNI, or one of the other major players in this, you know, game right now. And there are a lot on the left who are kind of making pretty bizarre claims as well, saying that this may just be a covert attempt from the Obama administration to try to distract people from the NSA, from the NSA scandal. But it looks pretty legitimate from.
Yeah, I wouldn't go there because I haven't seen that as. You know, I saw during the Bush years, every time it would come, it was like every other day. Code red, orange, be on the look. I haven't seen any of that, in the Obama years. I gotta be honest. I've seen almost none of that.
No, certainly true. And, you know, there would have been, ample opportunities for that to happen. We know that there was a lot of legislation that was sort of hung up for quite some time, and it probably could have moved through, quicker if they were willing to. Sort of cry wolf or whatnot, but we've seen a pretty admirable restraint coming from the administration for quite some time, especially considering there have been a number of credible threats and there have been multiple foiled terror plots.
So I see new there's a new liquid explosive out that can't be detected?
That's what it looks like. It looks like it's a type of liquid that can be put on clothes and then ignited as sort of an explosive device. Apparently this is not as easily to detect as some other explosive materials, so it's one of the top fears right now. That and another thing called, I guess, Franken devices, wherein you would put a bomb or some kind of improvised explosive device sewn into your body to avoid detection. It sounds like something out of the last Batman movie, but apparently that is getting a lot of attention.
Wow. Also, the Fort Hood trial started today?
Yes, it did, and it got quite a bit of attention for how bizarre it was. Nadal Malik Hassan has decided that he is going to be defending himself, which puts him in a pretty awkward position wherein he would have to cross-examine those that he had maimed when he shot 30 people and murdered 13 others. Today he conceded that the evidence is going to show that he was the shooter, but he is going to try to show his side of the story, mainly that he was viewing this as a war between two parties, and he switched sides at the last minute without telling anybody, and that he tried to avoid killing civilians. And that was, I guess in a weird perverse way, backed up by testimony that occurred within the courtroom today that described how Hassan ensured that only those who were willing to were wearing the uniform were shot when he burst into a room and opened fire for soldiers who were about to leave for Afghanistan and were in the process of getting their inoculations.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that couldn't you then argue that's treason and aiding the enemy and all of that, which is punishable by death?
It is, and he is facing the death penalty.
It's a very odd defense. I mean, you're saying, yes, I didn't do what you said, but I did something just as bad, if not worse.
Well, I think at this point he's probably just trying to make a point. This has been something that a lot of people have sort of warned about for years, that if we were to try, almost terrorists in open courts to give them a platform and whatnot. But it doesn't look like it's very effective. It doesn't look like he's necessarily swaying anybody with his arguments, since they're, pretty perverse on the face of it. So if anything, it looks like that argument has sort of been eliminated. So,
see, my point on it is, I don't think he's trying to make an argument. I think he's just trying to make the people who are suffering from this, the victims of this, just trying to stick his thumb in their eye one more time.
That would make sense as well. This is somebody who had a very clear mission to murder Americans, and, I guess if you can't murder, you might as well, hurt morale. So it's a very kind of dismaying case. It's very bizarre. And it doesn't look like he's going to be, let go anytime soon.
It's just bizarre. And, as I'm looking at this, I'm of the mindset, I don't know. It's just, I guess it's one of those screwed up things that happens occasionally in our system that I just don't like. Anyway, it looks like Bush underwent heart surgery.
Yes, he did. Yesterday during a yearly physical, he was found to have had a blocked artery, which is a little surprising considering how active he has been both as president and in the years following. He's always been a huge bike rider. He underwent open-heart surgery today, and his office released a statement saying that it went well, that he is in high spirits, and he is expected to resume the schedule as soon as Thursday.
Yeah, well, at least now him and Cheney will have something to commiserate about.
Exactly.
I wonder if they talk to each other much.
Apparently they don't. That's what we've been hearing for quite some time. It's also worth noting that at the Bush Presidential Library, apparently Cheney is a name that doesn't really come up that much.
Yeah, come to think about it, I don't remember. We were at the Bush Library and got to see the Wall of Freedom. I got to see the Twisted Metal from 9/11. We got to see how wonderful of a president he thought he was. But I don't remember. You're right. I don't remember much about Cheney. Interesting. And also, the Pentagon has reduced the number of furlough days from 11 down to 6. Why?
Well, this is a response to Congress not being able to overturn sequestration and leaving home for the August recess without doing it. They have lowered it from 11 days to 6 days because they say that they have found ways to save in other areas. This is not finalized yet. They still need to move it before Congress, since Congress is the one that allocates those funds. But it doesn't look like they're going to be very hesitant to sign off on making these changes, since nobody really wants to see a lot of people in the national security community furloughed at this time.
Yeah, especially now with what's going on in Yemen and across the Middle East.
Exactly.
And finally, the president was in Phoenix today. Did you see the big speech?
Yes, he did. He called for the elimination of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and called for overall mortgage reform in a way that would, prevent a lot of Americans from slipping into bankruptcy or foreclosure or whatnot. So far, this hasn't been the most receptive speaking tour he's been on.
Nope.
It's, generally resulted in a lot of yawns, since, there's not really much that can be done considering that there's a broken Congress and a lot of these ideas we have heard in different incantations before. But nevertheless, he is going out there and taking out his message and is continuing with that. And tonight, of course, he's going to be in Burbank appearing with Jay Leno, which is a shame since I can't stand Leno.
Yeah, well, either way, but I got to be honest, nothing I've heard so far, nothing really new to me, and nothing really bold in my view. You know, had you done some of the things he said today, I don't know, back in 2009, I'd have gone, well, that's a start. Here we are, though, you know, 2013. We're a little late to this ball game. You're talking about a couple million people who've lost their homes and are they've already suffered the ill effects of a banking industry that screwed them over, an economy that kicked them to the curb, and, you know, a program that they slow walked out and never really took hold as I had hoped or a lot of people had hoped. So I'm kind of like, you know, a little late, don't you think?
No, it's certainly true. It's not really sure what he can do now. He keeps on reminding the crowd that he has a limited amount of time for his second term. But he hasn't, necessarily presented a clear-cut argument for how this can be done. It just leaves a lot of people over here in D.C. scratching their heads.
Yeah, well, Justin, I appreciate you taking time for us away from your tango class. Keep up the good work and good luck.
Thank you.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service from Tango Class. As I've said before, the only time you'll see me dancing is if I'm on fire, so I give him credit for at least trying. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the dog.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed a permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.thericksmithshow.com.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are there things that you can do to encourage housing? One is don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom, allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up. The Obama administration has slow walked the foreclosure processes that have long existed, and as a result, we still have a foreclosure overhang.
Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Interesting story I found over at Think Progress on a new Habitat for Humanity's home that they built in Washington, D.C., that evidently you can heat the entire house with a hairdryer. That's how energy efficient, and that's how amazing this house is, and the technology that they used to build this home, which evidently wasn't all that much more expensive than regular construction. I mean, it's, after all, it's a Habitat for Humanity's home. You know, in Washington, D.C., they built, you know, half of the duplex for, you know, just a little bit over $200,000. Never going to have an electric bill. It's going to pretty much be energy independent, which I think is really, you know, the future of, and why didn't we hear any of that in this speech? You know, why didn't we hear, you know what, we want to start building low-cost housing for people instead of these McMansions. And I still remember, and I've got friends who, you know, I remember going, you've got a $300,000 mortgage? How in the hell did that happen? And how can you afford that? Well, the bank gave it to us. You know, they think we can do it. Well, I don't know. But I look at this house, and it's solar panels. It's just amazing. The technology is there. And, you know, when we were doing our trip, when we were doing the People's Tour for America, we ended up out in California. And you look at the IBEW local out there in Oakland, their training facility, from what I understand, is pretty much off the grid. I mean, it's energy independent. We could be doing this kind of stuff, but I don't know that the will is there. And I had hoped, you know, with the Recovery Act, that would have jump-started that. But you look here in Pennsylvania, what the Republicans have done, what Republican obstructionism has done. Here in this state, they have destroyed the solar industry. It was booming for a while. It was creating jobs. It was adding value to homes. It was a whole bunch of stuff. Then, you know, the Republicans allowed it to, well, to fade. You know, in places like New Jersey, the solar industry is booming because they've said, you know what, we think the energy company should have to purchase a certain amount of energy from renewable sources, and we're going to make sure that the credits for that are something you can sell back to them and make it more cost effective. Not here. Not here at all. And it's, again, another failure. And it's one that, you know, nobody other than, I think, I haven't heard anybody else talk about other than me. Another failure of the Republican leadership. Another industry. You know, they love small business. What about all the small businesses they put out of business by not fixing that glitch in the law? Oh, that's right. That's right. They were too busy trying to privatize our lottery and our wine and spirit shops. They were too busy with their blind faith ideology and too busy pointing their finger at another gay marriage. One man, one woman. And, you know, another man and another woman. And finally for tonight, under the heading of, you know, good family values and anyone can have a child, a Cumberland County woman, according to ABC News, is accused of leaving her baby again, for the second time in the 8-month-old child's life, this time inside the front door of a Rite Aid store in Silver Spring Township. The 29-year-old Enola woman, back in, I guess it was what, January? The kid is 8 months now. Back in January, she evidently, according to reports, allegedly left her daughter in the car at Walmart, a 20-week-old baby. 20-week-old infant left alone. Well, she went shopping. Hey, you know, it's a lot easier to go shopping without the child in tow. And here's the thing: I would expect that from a 16-year-old, a 29-year-old. Really, this is, you know, I don't advocate often for taking children away from people. This, I think it's time. Twice in 8 months. Can you imagine what this kid's going to go through for the next 17 years and 4 months? Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind. You can also email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like a
tide of blood beneath the blood sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array.